Well, this is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY FM in Philadelphia. It's now 4 o'clock. Joining me in the studio now on Fresh Air is painter and sculptor Cynthia Carlson. Cynthia is on the faculty of the Philadelphia College of Art, where she is the co-chairperson of the Painting and Drawing Department. A show of her recent work is now on exhibit at the Marion Locks Gallery, which is located on Walnut Street between 15th and 16th Streets in Philadelphia. And that show will be up until February 22nd. The canvases in this show, like much of her earlier work, have thick, textured surfaces of paint. She sometimes uses cake frosting applicators for paint application. She creates thick, layered, sometimes lacy patterns with paint. Some of these are brash and witty with strong, bright colors. Other canvases are more beige and dreamy, looking as if the paint was applied with a spatula, like frosting on a cake. Also in her Marion Locke show is an installation piece. This piece is an example of Cynthia's relief wallpaper, three-dimensional patterns applied directly to the wall. A couple of years ago at Art Park, Cynthia built a gingerbread house. She describes this as an image four times removed from its source. Her gingerbread house was an imitation of a baked version, which is an imitation of a mythological version, which represents an imitation of a real house. Cynthia's work has been shown at the Whitney Museum, the Museum of Modern Art, the Chicago Art Institute. Here in Philadelphia, her work has been shown at the Institute of Contemporary Art, the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and currently at the Marion Locks Gallery. In September, she will have a show at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Last May, as part of the Audiovision series, Cynthia was one of four artists who were commissioned to create works for radio for Arts Month. Later in the show today, we're going to hear the piece that Cynthia produced for the Audiovision series. She called it A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Middle-Aged Voice. Cynthia Carlson, it's a great pleasure to have you on Fresh Air today.
Thanks. It's nice to be back in the studios.
Great. I'd like to go back in time a little bit and talk to you about when you first started becoming interested in art. Can you tell us about, when you were young, what kind of, arts activities or whatever you kind of did, either in school or at home, that, helped develop the interest?
Well, I think one recognizes what they assume to be talent or artistic impulses by drawing, mainly. You know, you get involved with making things, images of things, and then filling in the colors, or painting in the colors,
right,
starting with coloring books and working towards making, I used to copy comic books, and then I made my own and filled in the colors. So I think it's really a drawing thing that starts, and it starts with imitation of objects.
It's funny because that's usually how people spot art potential also,
right,
in
right.
young people, if they can reproduce an image. Even on the matchbook covers, when you're supposed to send away to some kind of correspondence school for the arts, they're going to tell you if you have art potential based on your ability to reproduce an image that they have on this matchbook cover. But anyways, you're saying that when you were young, you noticed this interest by being able to reproduce things representationally.
Yeah, and I like to do it. I mean, I would spend a lot of time drawing. And when I played with other children, when we would just try to suggest games to each other, I would always suggest drawing. Nobody else wanted to but me.
But it's interesting to me, since your work is very non-representational now, with the exception of, say, the gingerbread house. I mean, your patterns are so removed from the ability to copy something in a drawing. Or are they?
Well, I never thought of myself as an abstract artist, I never thought that I would reach a point where I would be interested in abstract art, and that goes back a few years, at least 6 or 7 years. But I think that I got it. It's a little difficult to explain. For if one starts with a still life and makes a painting of it, I think what I do is, not literally, but figuratively, in a way, I sort of start with an abstract painting and make a thing out of it, make a still life out of it. So it's sort of a reversal. But I still don't think of myself as being primarily concerned with any really hardcore formalism.
So you're taking an abstract idea and making it into an object, is it?
Yeah, I think of them as kind of more reliefs or objects than I do paintings.
I'd be interested in hearing about how some of the phases that you went through before reaching the current approach that you take to your art. Like when you were in art school, for instance, what kind of work were you doing then?
Well, I was at the Art Institute in Chicago, and it was in the 60s, in the early 1960s when I started. And the trend or the gist of the education that we got there was we were learning to be fauves and at best abstract expressionists. So that was the sort of push that we were given from the teachers. As not quite, it wasn't part of my sensibility to gesture paint like that. It is very much now, but it wasn't at that time. I was very awkward at it. And I sort of glommed onto what for me was, I sort of was looking around for a style. You know, you get real nervous that you're supposed to have this thing that's your own personal image. And the easiest thing, I think, was surrealism, because that's sort of, it's easy to be creative with that kind of French surrealism where you take an object out of its context and you put it into another context, and it makes some kind of a metaphor or magic or like that. So I got involved with that kind of image making. I hate French surrealism now.
Why, is it too easy? Is it too obvious?
Yeah, I think I OD'd on it in my own work. Just I narrowed the range of focus and interest so much that I reacted to it myself and went in the opposite direction. Narrowed the focus of color and images down to a point where it just the reaction was to pack things in with as many different colors and as many different kinds of images as possible.
How did you move from that into more abstract forms and more involvement with the texture of paint and the pure color of paint?
Oh, it really had everything to do with I went to Colorado for a year and taught at the university there in Boulder. And I had never been out west before, and I was just completely taken with the landscape. And although I wasn't doing literal landscapes or realism, I had started making landscapes which were sort of patterns. The sky would be made into a pattern and the earth would be made into a pattern. And it had really much more to do with the kind of mood of color, which was so strong. And they became really about mood. They were very pastoral. I love those paintings from, I think, the 72 and 73. They're very easy. And that's the way I felt there. It was just very pleasurable to be there. If you live in the city your whole life, which I had, your whole experience of the space is vertical. And out west, the expanses were so incredible to me. They still are. I love going out there. Something about the mood and the strength of the color was what I began trying to work with. And even then, I don't think that I began, when I say I began trying to work with it, it sounds as if I made an intentional decision. I don't think I work that way in making an intentional decision. I sort of always understand what I've done in hindsight. So I started working on these things and in hindsight realized that that's what they were about.
So you finding your style was not a kind of immediate outgrowth of you looking for your own style. I mean,
it was in school. That was the pressure was, okay, now, well, we've learned our skills. Now, what are we going to do with them? So I was looking around for something to snatch onto. But this was several years after getting out of school that I was just sort of, there was a gradual metamorphosis of things. Also, I tend to change pretty quickly. I tend to be a rather eclectic artist in the sense that I go through a lot of rapid changes. So it's very hard for me to make any kind of dogmatic statements about what kind of art I like and don't like or will or won't do, because I promise you whatever I say I won't do in 10 years, I'm sure I'll be doing it.
Does that strike you as being kind of good, bad, or neither?
No, it strikes me as being personal to my personality. I mean, some artists can take one idea and keep it meaningful and keep it alive for their whole lives. And other people tend to change quickly and rapidly, and I tend to be like that.
How many years have you been involved with the kind of patterning that your current show at Marion Locks is an example of?
I think there were indications of that going back to about 1970, something like that. Maybe 71, I'm not sure.
Does it make to you a kind of a philosophical statement of any sort that you're, you know, working with paint but not necessarily using a brush, and that you're using a kind of utensil that's really not an art utensil at all, but it's a kind of food utensil? When you do use things like, pastry applicator tubes and things like that?
Not directly or not intentionally in the work. I think I could say there's sort of two kinds of artist, and this is my own sort of categorization, and you don't have to be a part of either one. Part, you know, it can be part of both. But I think there are literary artists that work from specific ideas, and they have an idea, and then the object that they make is a fulfillment of that idea. And then I think there are people that work out of a process, and the process evolves into the product and becomes the product. And that's the way I usually had worked up until very recently. I always worked out of the process, and the process itself suggested what the work would become about. And it's tricky to pinpoint that, you know, in a sort of philosophical sense. But I had some specific ideas about there. It, for me, when the work works the best is when there's a sort of edge between when it's decorative, but there's also something ugly about it at the same time. I mean, that's always fascinated me, when something can have characteristics opposite at the same time, Jekyll and Hyde, sort of. And I think we all have that in our personality. So there's an edge that I recognize in the work when, in the heavily textured things, for example, maybe at a distance, they appear to be very elegant almost in their design. And from close up, they're so visceral, they're disgusting. And when, so if it becomes too decorative or too pretty, it doesn't interest me. It has to go almost to a point where it feels like you have sugar in your mouth. And then from being pretty, it gets kind of disgusting. And that's what I like.
You are kind of working in a way with the notion of decoration, like on your installation piece, which is relief wallpaper. You know, it's applied directly to the wall.
It's not, actually.
It isn't?
No, it looks it. And that's,
sure does.
Yeah, that's what most people think, but it's done separately. And then packed up in boxes, and I take it and go where I go and put it on the wall, either permanently or impermanently, with depending on the kind of glue I use.
It seems to me to be dealing with the idea that we kind of attach things to the wall for decoration, and some wallpaper is kind of artsy, some of it is just kind of plain, and some of it's kind of crass, depending on your taste. But you're taking your artwork and applying it to a wall as if it was wallpaper, and it has that kind of a very exaggerated sense of relief, like that red velvet type wallpaper has.
When I started working, it goes back a little bit. When I started working with the thick paint, that came out of the experience of being in Colorado too, because what I began doing when I was living there was I began technical mountain climbing. And when you are involved with that kind of activity, you have a really very sensitive and sensual relationship to the rock, where every little change and every little nuance in the rock is of utmost significance and importance to you. I still have dreams about rocks. I mean, not, you know, they're so wonderful to me if I see when I have to touch it and get near it. I just respond to that surface. And although I never intended to do that, it was a friend of mine, when he came into my studio after not having seen the work for a long time, and then he saw all these new paintings, which were really thick, he just cracked up and said, "I know what you're doing. You're making paintings to climb on." And he was kidding me, but in actual, that made me realize that, of course, that's where the ideas were coming from, not in a literal way, because I wasn't trying to make mountains, but it was definitely coming out of, because I was very obsessed by it. I was rushing upstate. Even when I moved back to New York, I was rushing upstate every weekend to climb. So it evolved from a mountain or from that surface ideas of rocks, but also I've always responded to the decorative arts of Islamic design and book illuminations, the borders, and sort of design traditions. As also what I really like is I just like really packed, close, dense forms, lots of tchotchkes. That seems to be I just respond to things that are dense with lots of variation, and that's exactly what crops up in my work.
Would you like your paintings to be used as decoration by people who buy them?
Well, it gets complicated and tricky, but it then you talk about what the intention of art is or what it's for. I mean, I think I'm interested in decoration as art, not in the pejorative sense. In a way, what I would like to say is that decoration is art, is what I would try to say in my work. And not in the show here, but in a show that's going on in New York right now, I did another wallpaper piece. And on the opposite wall, I did very large versions of exactly the same pieces that were in the wallpaper design, except that I did them as single units, and they're much larger. So my intention was to make a metaphor. Well, in one case, when it's repeated in a pattern and it's tiny, it's a decoration, it's wallpaper. And look what happens when you blow it up. It's by itself and it's sculpture. And what's the difference anyway? Is what I, you know, was what I was trying to work with that idea. So I have, there's a group of people now working with sort of decorative sources that's evolving, and I'm real interested in their work.
Now, what you're talking about is different than the person who, for instance, wants to, like, decorate their living room by buying a canvas whose main colors match the covering of the couch. And that's decoration in a different sense, I think.
I guess that's interior decoration.
Yeah.
I've always just been interested in decorative elements. I mean, even in architecture, I've always liked looking at the Louis Sullivan and his fascination with decoration as part and parcel of his whole notion of the way he worked.
Now, that was all really out of fashion for a while, wasn't it, when less is more were the bywords of...
it was out of fashion during the 60s in the mainstream of art, which was minimal and boxed itself into a corner again. This whole current sort of concern with pattern and decoration is just that... An explosion of color and busyness and lushness.
How do your philosophies about your own art, I mean, your approach to your own art, what pleases you in your own art, how does that affect what you teach at art school? I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, because everyone who's in art school is taught with all the biases of, like, what's being done during that period, if you know what I'm saying. Like, if you went to art school when less is more were the bywords, then decoration was probably a bad word.
I guess one could still use that in a pejorative way, meaning it as a negative criticism if it exhibited a certain kind of characteristic of superficiality in the way, for example, the use of composition or the way color was being applied. It could be applied in a decorative way. But... to go back into the history of art, I mean, Matisse is certainly a shining and glowing example of someone who is a fine artist indeed, and history has given him that credit, and who was extremely decorative. He's always been influential on me in mm-hmm. the character of his work, which I find extremely exhilarating and joyous. I like that same character in my work, that there's a nice energy and exuberance to it.
There's a group of women artists, I think particularly, I guess, of like Judy Chicago, who have made a real point of giving some kind of representation to their feminist point of view within their art. Has that ever been a compelling possibility to you, expressing any feminism or other political attitude in your art? And has that been a need at any point? A lot of women artists have talked about the difficulties they faced in art school before there was a strong feminist bond.
Well, I never asked those questions when I was in school. I mean, it was before that was around or available, and I never quite thought about it. And I had all men teachers, except perhaps for one. And I was a sort of a good student, and I never asked good student in the sense that I never challenged anybody. I wouldn't think of that as a good student now. I like students that will confront me on what I tell them and not buy it 100%. But I just was a good girl and listened to whatever anybody told me. And I guess I must have been pretty firm in the notion that I was going to be an artist, because it never occurred to me that someone would dare not take me serious because I was a woman. At the same time, when I finished graduate school, I could write letters applying to colleges and sign my name C. Carlson, knowing that I would automatically get a negative response if I addressed myself with my full name as a woman. And I did get my responses addressed to Mr. C. Carlson. And there never occurred to me that there was any kind of a contradiction in that. But I've never been overtly intending to make feminist or political imagery in my art, although it cannot be denied, and I don't make a case of saying, no, no, it's not there. Obviously, when you're using all your cooking tools, and I've made canvases about sewing and woven canvases that I used to make my paintings by cutting up strips of painting, strips of canvas and then painting on them. So I can't ignore that it's there, but I've never had it in my conscious mind that that was what I was trying to do.
I think there were one or two examples of that that type of work that you were doing recently at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in their drawing show.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is painter and sculptor Cynthia Carlson, and she is the co-chairperson of the Painting and Drawing Department at the Philadelphia College of Art, and has a display of her recent work at the Marion Locks Gallery in Center City, Philadelphia, which is on Walnut Street between 15th and 16th Streets. Do you see the situation as having changed in art school now? I mean, there are women, example yourself, on faculties of art schools.
Not many. I mean, there are a few at where I'm teaching, and it's still not something that in any way is sort of been equalized in any way. But the tables are turning slowly, and it even works in a mild prejudice the other way, in that if there's a job, which there are so few of now, if there is a job, sometimes it's harder for the men to get them right now because everybody needs a few token women around here and there. But they still, for the most part, aren't part of they don't have important positions, and they don't have, most of them don't have tenure. And I must say that I'm not an example of that, because I've been at Philadelphia College of Art a long time, and I have tenure, and I'm co-chairing now, and so I'm not an example of that, but it still exists around the country. And my own education was, it never, so I was such a good student, or, you know, non-questioning student in that sense. I never really realized that there was anything wrong or anything really peculiar that was separating me from the men. I mean, in fact, I was much of a chauvinist myself. When I got out of school, it was me and the boys would sit down and talk about art, and, oh yes, perhaps the wife could bring us a cup of tea while we were talking about this heavy stuff. It never occurred to me that I was guilty of the same thing. But when I went back to Chicago some time ago, and I went to look up someone at the Art Institute, and he was one of my teachers, and I was going to say hello to him, and I was told I could find him in this room, and I went in the room, and there was a critique going on, and it was a graduate student who was a woman, and there were seven men sitting around, and they were all critiquing her work, and it made me violently angry to see how they were behaving in the critique, which it appeared to me that, I mean, I know from teaching 12 years that I don't have all the answers and that I can make suggestions to the students, but by and large, they have to figure those things out for themselves. And I know I'm making my suggestions out of my own prejudices, especially on a graduate level where there has been a time for a personal development. And I thought that these men were behaving as if whatever it was that they were saying as if that's the way it was. And she better get hip if she ever really intended to be an artist. And she just wasn't given enough legitimacy or credence for her own thoughts. And that's the first time that it ever occurred to me that there was that kind of brainwashing or that kind of bastion of sexism. It really hit home at that moment, although other people have been aware of it for a longer time.
Do you deal with that in any way as a teacher now?
Well, and now as a teacher, I try to give the students as much sympathy and confidence as possible. And by sympathy and confidence, I don't mean being easy on them. Sometimes what they need is a good kick in the pants. Just that one encourages them to go about finding out what they're about and setting up their lives, if they're men or women or what. Not to treat them as if, well, just get on the best you can because you're going to get married in a few years and it won't matter anyway.
Mm-hmm. Cynthia, I'd like to hear about what part of your life art is outside of the art that you create. Do you spend a lot of time going to galleries and museums looking at art? Do you spend a lot of time like reading art books, or is most of your art time spent, you know, teaching and making your own art?
Yeah, I think I spend most of my time involved with art and art-related activities, museums and galleries. The majority of the people that I call my friends are involved with art in some way, either in making art or criticizing art or buying art or curating art, something like that. And that's a little bit of a regret, because I enjoy other things, and there are a lot of other things that I'm involved with. But somehow it evolves like that. I wonder if other fields are as sort of close-knit and exclusive as artists or the art world tends to be, because it seems to me there's room. It gets a little closed sometimes, too closed, stuffy. I don't mean stuffy in a conservative way. I just mean that there's other air to breathe, and sometimes you get so wrapped up in it you don't see it or sense it.
Mm-hmm. Do you sense a strong difference in the like art atmosphere in Philadelphia and New York, because you live in New York and teach in Philadelphia and spend a good deal of time in both cities?
Well, I'm here 2 to 3 days a week, and during that time I'm mostly involved with the activities of school, because I have a lot to accomplish in that time. So I don't really have a good sense of what the art life here is about. But over the years teaching here, I've met a lot of people and seen some socially. There's a lot of very interesting, fine people working here. And I'm not really part of that group so much, because I guess home is where home as places. I don't have my own home here, and somehow that's the nucleus that's important. So no matter how long I've been here, I somehow feel can't not feel like a tourist, because my home isn't here. My things aren't around me. I don't have things here. I just bring a suitcase in every week.
How do you deal with your home space? Like, what are some of the things you've done in your home space? I'm wondering if you have like a lot of decoration or decorative things within it, if you have your own art on your own walls.
I have a collection of folk art I'm really interested in. My own work has been very influenced by contemporary or 20th century folk art, which is also very excessive and obsessive. Just my own art is just like that. And the Gingerbread House came out of, I'm sure, that kind of an experience. I know it did. And so I collect folk art, and I have a lot of that around. And I have a lot of my friend's art around. And then occasionally I get sick of everything and put it away, and it's just nice to see a white wall. I just moved into a new space, so I'm delighted just to see nothing but white walls for a while. And then I'm sure it'd take me no time at all to crowd them up.
What are some of the objects that you really cherish? And, you know, either art or just objects that are a part of your life but are not art objects.
Sentimental things, yeah. You know, that friends have given me. Not necessarily handsome or interesting to look at, but just because there are associations that have to do with relationships with other people that they're... a good friend of mine died a couple of years ago, and I have this terrible lamp that I don't know why. I always thought of it when I was... I always noticed it when I was in her home, and I have that lamp, and it's really ugly, but it's a real important piece of furniture, because it reminds me of that person, and I have strong feelings about her, so...
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how your relation to something changes when it has that kind of personal, personal connection.
And little cards and reproductions, and I know some people that have just totally gotten rid of everything they own. Though I mean, that sometimes your possessions get real oppressive, and it's nice to just think really Spartan like, get rid of everything and live really simply. Uh-huh. And there's this desire in everybody. At some moments, to run away from everything and live simply.
Yeah, there's also that desire to accumulate things.
Yes.
To have those things you like near you. It is a really conflicting desire. When you do something like a piece at like Art Park, which is where you did the Gingerbread House, and you've done stuff at PS1 in Queens, it's different than the usual artist approach to art, because you're going to a place, you have a limited time that you're going to be in residence there or creating there, and in that limited time you're going to probably first generate the idea for a piece and create and finish the piece, which is really different than the opposite approach, which is the more traditional one of germinating the idea for a piece, creating the piece, and once the piece is done, perhaps it will be in a gallery or in a museum. I mean, it's not, you know, no one asks you to do anything with that piece till it's done.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like that kind of
commission rather than just...
I guess it's commissions too, but there's usually not that kind of quick, okay, you have a week here, and within that week you're going to do a piece.
Yeah.
Do you like working under that kind of, environment, that more almost improvisational?
But yes, both, very much. I mean, the studio activity is really private, and it's in isolation, and sometimes it's very lonely. Being an artist is that way to a degree. And so going to Art Park and then having to fulfill a certain requirement in a certain period of time was fascinating. I was terrified. And what was fascinating was I'd never worked under that kind of structure before. And the things that grew out of it were wonderful and important to me. I mean, the piece itself, I was very, very happy with. But the side things, which I was not prepared for, was the social things that happened. And that was the sort of, there were a number of people all working up there at the same time, and there developed an enormous camaraderie where, despite whether you even like the person or you like their art or not, you just all got involved with wanting to really see those people get the job done well. And and it was a terrific camaraderie and sharing of experiences and problems and helping each other. And the other thing that happened there in that particular location was I have this friend, and once we were sitting in a bar, a country western bar, and people were dancing and they were jumping up and they were having a real fine time jumping around. And my friend is a philosopher, and he said, wouldn't it be nice to make something that you would have people respond to immediately like that? That must be very rewarding. And I always thought of that, and I never thought of doing something like that. But that inadvertently, that's exactly what happened at Art Park. And the people that addressed them, that I did address myself to in that way, were children, which astounded me. I mean, they were coming like swarms of hornets when they get off the bus across the field. They'd be coming in swarms to get to the gingerbread house. And they knew it belonged to them, and they took it over, and they went into an immediate fantasy. And they knew that the adults were the ones that were off their turf. And, they were very territorial. They knew they were boss because it was theirs, it belonged to them. And that was a very... it was a very touching experience. It was, especially because I have a hard time with children. I never, it's not that I don't like them. I just don't relate to them very well. After about 20 minutes, I want them to go away, and I want to have an adult conversation. And that's not a bad or good thing. That's just my personality. So I was overwhelmed that I had made this thing that communicated so well with a group of people that I didn't relate to myself.
That's interesting.
It was wonderful. It was a byproduct.
In the show that's on now at the Marion Lux Gallery, and the patterning pieces that are there, how much of those patterns are, planned in your mind beforehand? How do you balance in your work organization and improvisation?
Are you talking about the paintings or the installation, or
the
both?
The paintings.
I usually begin just more or less arbitrarily by making a couple of I might set up some small... what I consider not very important problem, like just deciding to use a couple of colors or maybe only one straight line, and then build from there. Those are all process. As I say, that when you decide to take one color, and then let's see what happens if you put another color next to it, in what proportion. So there, I really don't usually start with a specific intention of an idea. I try to let it build out of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not true with the wallpaper pieces, and it's not true with the... gingerbread house. With those, as I said before, as two kinds of artists, I have been a process artist, and those started with ideas. The house was an idea, and the wallpaper pieces are an idea.
Aside from the gingerbread house, have you been around, made a point of being around galleries or museums when your work is on display to just maybe anonymously be able to watch the response of people to your work?
No, I don't like it.
You don't like to see it?
Not too much. You feel very vulnerable when you've done something and you put assumingly everything you could put into it. It's like standing in a room without your clothes on, with everyone else is fully clothed and garmented. You're standing there in complete vulnerability. It makes me very nervous. And I was surprised that happened a couple of years ago when I brought my students up to see my show in New York. And I just got completely crazy. They were in the gallery. I wanted to go away and hide. I was surprised that I had that reaction. So I'd rather hear about it later.
Uh-huh. Okay, listen, if you're just joining us, my guest is Cynthia Carlson, and her work is available to be seen in Philadelphia now. There's a display of her recent work now at the Marion Locks Gallery, which is on Walnut Street between 15th and 16th Streets. And come next September, she'll be having a show at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia. Well, perhaps you remember, last May, throughout public radio, was Arts Month. And one of the things we did here on WUHY was a series that was called the Audio Vision Series. And for it, we commissioned four visual artists to do works for radio, which was, you know, for all the artists involved, the, you know, a first attempt at a sound, at a completely sound medium. Cynthia Carlson was one of the four artists who created pieces for the Audio Vision series. And in just a couple of minutes, we're going to hear the piece that Cynthia did for the series. Cynthia, I'd like to ask you, if you don't mind asking you this, how you responded to the whole thing, to that thought of, like, working in a different medium? You know, in sound as opposed to, you know, paint or, you know, sound isn't really an object in the way, you know, paint or sculpture is.
Well, I said yes, I think, almost immediately, because I felt so up in the air about my own work. I mean, it was right after I did the house, and that was so final and so complete that I knew I was going to have a hard time working after that, because it felt like the end of a major thing, and whatever would happen next would be floundering around. So it was a perfect time to try anything, you know, sure, whatever it is, sure, I'll try it. I don't know what I'd do anyway anymore. I'm ready for a change. And also because of the experience at Art Park had been one that had a lot to do with a communication of some sort, that the notion of trying to use a communicative medium really interested and fascinated me. So I was glad to have the opportunity to do the piece. And as far as I can tell, my first thing was to get over the problem of worrying about being original. I mean, you know, radio has such a magnificent long history. The first thing was, okay, you know, you don't have to do something that no one else has done before, and so just worry about what you do want to do.
Do you want to say anything else about the piece before we hear it?
No, I'd like to hear it again. I haven't heard it for a long time.
Okay, well, before we do hear it, Cynthia, I want to thank you for being here this afternoon on Fresh Air.
And for asking me, thank you.
Cynthia Carlson is the co-chairperson of the Painting and Drawing Department at the Philadelphia College of Art. Again, a show of her recent work is now on display at the Marion Locks Gallery in Center City. Well, now we're going to listen to the piece that Cynthia did for the Audio Vision series last year. She called it a portrait of the artist as a young middle-aged voice.
Hi, how are you? What's new? What have you been doing lately? Have you got any news? Well, how are you? It's really great to hear from you. Listen, why don't we try to get together sometime? Maybe we could have lunch and talk. Or let's have dinner. What's good for you? Well, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday I'm teaching in Philadelphia. The weekends I spend with Mitchell. Then Tuesday nights I'm hung up, so Monday nights actually. But not for the next 4 weeks. How about after that? Oh, you're going to be away? Well, listen, why don't you call me when you get back, and we'll see if we can set something up then. Listen, it's been really nice talking to you again. Well, I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
If you wish your call to be returned, please leave your phone number, date of birth, your social security number, place of employment, type of work done, previous place of employment, type of work done there, your mother's first name, your...
He said...
No, let's not go out tonight.
Then she said...
I'd really like to go to a movie or something.
Then he said...
I'm tired. I worked very hard today.
Then she said...
But we stayed home all last week, and I'm kind of bored, and I'd just like to go out and be around other people.
Then he said,
it's a weekend night, and there's always long lines at the theaters, and I hate waiting in line and being herded around like cattle.
Then she said,
well, we could look for a local movie house that wouldn't be so crowded.
Then he said,
they always run horrible movies, and that's why there's never a line.
Then she said,
well, maybe there's a movie on TV.
He said,
want to go up to the country tomorrow?
Then she said,
I don't feel much like driving for 2 hours up and back and then rushing back to the party.
Then he said,
what party?
Then she said,
don't you remember? I told you last week we were invited to a party after the opening of that friend of mine from Colorado.
Then he said,
you never told me about a party.
Then she said,
sure I did, last week.
Then he said,
I don't remember.
Then she said,
well, anyway, I don't feel like going to the country if it means not going to the party.
Then he said,
I haven't had the dog out for a good run in weeks, and I have to take her out to the country or she'll drive me crazy with too much energy.
Then she said,
well, would we be back in time?
Then he said,
you know I hate rushing from place to place without time to relax and think.
Then she said,
well, you go yourself then, and I'll go to the party. The dog always comes first anyway.
He said,
no,
let's not go out tonight.
Then she said,
I'd really like to go to a movie or something.
Then he said,
I'm tired. I worked very hard today.
Then she said,
We stayed home all last week. And I'm kind of bored. And I'd just like to go out and be around other people.
Then he said,
It's a weekend night, and there's always a long line at the theaters. And I hate waiting in line and being herded around like cattle.
Then she said,
We could look for a local movie house that wouldn't be so crowded.
Then he said,
They always run horrible movies. And that's why there's never a line.
Then she said,
Well, maybe there's a movie on TV.
He said,
Want to go up to the country tomorrow?
Then she said,
I don't feel much like driving for two hours up and back and then rushing to the party.
Then he said,
What party?
Then she said,
Don't you remember I told you last week we were invited to a party after the opening of that friend of mine from Colorado?
Then he said,
You never told me about a party.
Then she said,
Sure I did, last week.
Then he said,
I don't remember.
Then she said,
Anyway, I don't feel like going to the country if it means not going to the party.
Then he said,
I haven't had the dog out for a good run in weeks, and I have to take her out to the country or she'll drive me crazy with too much energy.
Then she said,
Would we be back in time?
Then he said,
You know I hate rushing from place to place without time to relax and think.
Then she said,
You go yourself then, and I'll go to the party. The dog always comes first anyway.
Can't come to the phone right now, but if you'd leave your name and telephone number and whatever message you'd care to, I'll get back to you very soon as I monitor this machine frequently. Thanks for calling.
Because this is a machine. Please don't. Listening to my messages is almost as good as going through the mail. So speak after the beep, and thank you for hanging in there. Goodbye.
I really have to sit down and think about my relationships to men. I want to tell her everything. I really want to share things with him. I'd like to be able to relate to you. I'm trying to open up to someone that can't be open. He doesn't understand what I'm saying. I'd like someone who can share my interests. There are things that he just really doesn't like. She and I could never relate in terms of food. It's nice to have somebody that close, somebody that knows what I want. I don't understand. I just want answers. Look, I'm not trying to put you down. I just want to understand what you're saying. She's been holding back, and she won't tell me things.
I really have to sit down and think about my relationship to men.
I really want to share things with her.
I really want to relate to him.
I'm trying to open up to someone that can't be open.
I want to tell him everything.
She doesn't understand what I'm saying.
I'd like someone who can share my interests.
There are things she really doesn't like.
We could never relate in terms of food.
We could never relate in terms of food.
It's nice to have somebody that close, somebody that knows what I want.
I don't understand. I just want answers.
Look, I'm not trying to put you down. I just want to understand what you're
saying.
She's
been holding back and won't tell me things.
There's a very strong feeling between us. I can't explain it, but I know it's there and we both feel
it. I love
him. There's a communication gap. Things that we just can't share that are separating
us. Do you think we could ever be together?
I want to have a meaningful relationship
with him. There'll never be anyone but him.
I want to tell him everything.
I'm trying to open up to someone that can't be open.
We could never relate in terms of food.
It's nice to have somebody that close, somebody that knows what I want.
I really have to sit down and think about my relationship.
I'm not trying to put him down. I just want to understand what he's saying.
She doesn't understand what I'm saying.
There's a very strong feeling between us. I want to tell him everything. It's there, and we both feel it.
I really have to sit down and think about my
relationship
with women.
I really don't want to sit around and think about my relationships with women.
I really want to share things with him.
I really don't want to share anything with him.
I'm trying to open up to someone that
can't be open. I don't
want to relate
to her.
I want to tell her everything.
I'm not trying to open up to anyone that can be open.
She doesn't understand what I'm saying.
I'd like someone who can share my interests.
I don't want to tell her anything.
She doesn't understand what I'm saying.
She understands what I'm saying.
It's nice to have someone
like
that
someone
close, someone that knows
interests.
What I want.
She and I could never relate in terms of
food.
There
are things she really likes.
I don't understand. I just want answers.
I love him.
We can only relate in terms of food.
It's nice to have somebody that close, somebody that knows what
Look,
I want.
Look, I am not trying to put you down. I just want to understand what you're saying.
I don't understand. I just want answers.
I understand there are no answers.
I want to tell him everything. There's a communication gap. Things that we just cannot share that are separating us.
I want to have a meaningful relationship with him.
Do you think we could ever be together?
I don't understand. I just want answers.
I want to have a meaningful relationship with her.
There'll never be anyone but him.
I want to have a meaningless relationship with her.
I really want to relate to her.
There's a communication gap, things that we just cannot share that are separating
us. I'm trying
to
open up to someone that can't be open.
It's nice to have someone that close, someone that knows what I want.
I really have to sit down and think about my relationship to men.
I'd like someone who can share my interests.
I really have to sit down and think about my relationships to women.
She and I could never relate in terms of food.
I really want to relate to him.
But I would appreciate it if you would leave me a message on this machine. You must know it takes a few minutes for the beep to sound. Please wait, then give me your name, phone number, day and time you call, and I will call you as soon as I can. Thank you.
You know how things get changed around in your mind over a period of time until you can't remember if they really happened that way, or if they were dreams, or if they never happened and you only wish they did? Or perhaps they happened to someone else, but it makes a good story, so over the years in telling, it somehow gets turned around until it happened to you. I can remember telling the following things to different people at different times during my life. I no longer know how much is actually true, although some things are factual. I remember telling them and not the event itself. Perhaps some of the things are not true at all, though the only important thing now is that it makes no difference.
I once saw a young peacock courting a bush.
I have a hard time getting angry.
When my father got very old, he went outside and lay down on the ground and asked my sister to cover him up and leave him to die.
Once I got a Bonnie Braids doll for Christmas. I pulled out her braids, I painted her face with nail polish, and got a spanking.
I loved school and had a good time.
I camped in a garbage dump in Italy.
On vacation in Wisconsin, my father caught a big snapping turtle while fishing. He put him in a pail. I spilled a new box of Crayolas in that pail and cried.
Once I saw an ant war. There was a row of red ants and a row of black ants, and they charged each other.
I got caught cheating on a history exam, but talked my way out of it.
When I was 10, I beat a schoolmate up so badly she was bleeding internally. She was teasing me about being adopted.
When I was 9 days old, I was adopted. My mother said I was a bargain since I cost only $50.
I saw a pig in the Salzburg Zoo that was snoring really loud.
I never learned my multiplication tables of 8 and 9 because I was at the fire department drawing fire trucks for a cleanup week poster.
There was an abandoned gold mine in Colorado that had arsenic forming on the rotting rafters. It looked like hairy shaving cream.
When I was little, my sister and I used to bring home stray dogs and hide them in the basement.
In Georgia once, I saw a Dalmatian dog in a cage in the zoo.
The gym teacher had a Band-Aid box of contraceptives in his office.
When I was little, I got lice. My mother washed my hair in kerosene and put a nylon stocking on my head.
The first time I ever tried to fish, I swung a fish line around and hooked my own eyelid.
In the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago, they had a crow that said, "Hello, boy," and a camel that did the soft shoe.
On the way to California, I dug up a cactus in Texas, and the next day the whole car, including my parents, was covered with little red ants that bite.
On the same trip, I ate 12 oranges in one day and got a rash on my behind.
Sometimes the boy across the alley and I would color together on the back porch. He stuttered very badly, and when we were together, I stuttered too.
The same zoo, the Lincoln Park Zoo, had a sloth bear named Benji, whose bottom lip moved up and down all the time, and he looked like he was singing.
My brother-in-law once ate 13 pork chops for dinner.
My other brother-in-law told his wife, my sister Shirley, that when he was fired on in Vietnam, he ducked to miss the bullets.
When my mother died, I saw my father cry for the first time.
In Switzerland, I was on a hike in the mountains by myself and got lost and very frightened.
My cat Hobart learned to get the freezer door of my refrigerator open, and on 3 different occasions he went in and defrosted himself a steak.
We camped in a tiny tent on Mount Marcy for 3 days in January 1974. It was 22 degrees below zero.
I once asked the minister of our church, who came first, the caveman or Adam and Eve? He answered me, "How should I know? I wasn't there."
I spent a year in Europe when I was 20 years old, and I hitchhiked around, I slept in hostels and on beaches, and lived on $2 a day for the whole time.
I know someone who said he was in the process of translating the world's religions into Morse code.
Once I woke up in a burning apartment. When I ran out onto the street, I managed to grab and take with me my hair rollers, a diaphragm, and a sleeping bag.
I once dreamt my cat Hobart was sailing around the loft on a skateboard. I woke up laughing.
My father came to visit me in Colorado one summer. When he got off the plane and came down the ramp into the airport, he handed me a dill pickle he had put in his pocket.
It took me 10 tries to stand up on water skis.
When I was 13, a boy in our church asked me to go steady. He gave me a washer for a ring.
My best friend died in a car accident not long ago. It was the most painful thing that has ever happened to me.
On a drive to Boulder, Colorado, my father said, "You got to know your onions around here."
I fell 65 feet in a mountain climbing accident and spent 5 days in the hospital with a cracked chest and a large yellow bump on my head.
I was in a girls' club named Turcos. We met weekly, had jackets with our names printed on them, and hung around together.
I once slept in a bed in Tangiers that had bed bugs.
When I was learning to rappel, I leaned off the cliff edge backwards, but forgot to move my feet, so I was hanging upside down in space by the rope.
My cat put turds in a friend of mine's shoes.
Once, in Calaques, Spain, I was introduced to Marcel Duchamp.
The 42nd meeting of the Turquos was called to order on May 20th at 7:19 p.m. by the President Karen Everson at the home of Cindy Panerero. The attendance was taken and Susan Fritz was absent. The minutes from the previous meeting were read and approved. The dues were taken and the treasurer's report was read and approved. Cash on hand is $10.34. The president called for old business, and Eileen made a motion that if Eileen Weinschenker did not mention coming to the next meeting herself, she will not be allowed into the club. Cynthia mentioned that our next club outing would be miniature golfing. It will cost 50 cents plus car fare. It was decided upon that the club preamble will be said only at formal meetings and banquets. An adjoining club meeting of the other freshman club was mentioned, but was voted out 3-1. There was no more old business. The president then asked for new business. Cynthia mentioned that as long as Eileen wouldn't be able to have the pajama party, and no one else could have it, we should have another party, namely, a boy and girl party. There was an open discussion on the matter, and the president finally tabled the matter. Myrna will find out for the next meeting if Ronnie has any cute boyfriends. Cindy motioned to adjourn the meeting, and Myrna seconded it. The meeting was adjourned at 7:50 p.m., after which Cindy served refreshments. Myrna will have the next meeting. Respectfully submitted, Cynthia Carlson, Recording Secretary, Turquoise Girls Club, 1956.
We just heard a piece that was produced last year for the Audio Vision series by painter and sculptor Cynthia Carlson, who spoke with us here on Fresh Air a little earlier in the program. Cynthia, again, is a painter who currently has a show on exhibit in Philadelphia at the Marion Locks Gallery on Walnut Street between 15th and 16th. She's also the co-chairperson of the painting and drawing department at the Philadelphia College of Art. The Audio Vision series was a series that was produced here at WUHY last year during May, which was Public Radio Arts Month, and we commissioned four visual artists to produce pieces for radio. We just heard this piece that Cynthia Carlson produced.